Hello and welcome to another episode of the Politics Theory of the Podcast. My name is Alex Doherty. In recent years, a number of economists and political commentators have argued that our era of stagnating economies, businesses that increasingly substitute rent for profit-making, and monopolistic platform giants that prey upon our data can no longer usefully be described as capitalist. Amongst their number is the economist and former finance minister of Greece, Yanis Varoufakis. In his latest book, Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism, Yanis argues that the owners of big tech have in effect become feudal overlords, replacing capitalism with a fundamentally new system. In our conversation, we discussed why Yanis believes capitalism is no longer the appropriate term to describe contemporary economic and social relations. We also talked about the financial crisis, the COVID-19 pandemic, and how central bank responses to both crises serve to build the power of the tech giants. And I also put to Yanis some of the arguments made by those who are critical and suspicious of the techno-feudalist thesis. Finally, we also briefly discussed the situation in Gaza and why Yanis believes reports of the decline of US global hegemony are, for the moment, rather exaggerated. Today's episode is brought to you by PTO supporters on Patreon and also by Verso Books, who have lots of great left-wing titles perfect for PTO listeners. One you might like to check out is Workshop of the World, Essays in People's History by Raphael Samuel. Described by Stuart Hall as one of the most outstanding original intellectuals of his generation, Raphael Samuel's historical writing transformed what history was, who was allowed to do it, and who it was for. Workshop of the World, Essays in People's History is a new collection of his essays, from his pioneering study of the influence of the Catholic Church on England's Irish population, to his expansive and erudite essay on the itinerant labourers of Victorian Britain. Guided by both a political engagement as well as a methodological commitment to uncovering the stories of ordinary people, Workshop of the World will introduce Raphael Samuel's work to a new generation of readers. Workshop of the World, Essays in People's History by Raphael Samuel, edited by John Merrick, is out now from Verso Books. And now to today's interview. Yanis Varoufakis is an economist, co-founder of DM25, and professor of economics at the University of Athens. He is the author of Talking to My Daughter, A Brief History of Capitalism, and Adults in the Room, a memoir of his time as finance minister of Greece, amongst other works. His latest book, which was the topic of our conversation, is Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism. We'll talk more about how what you describe as techno-feudalism emerged and why you believe it no longer makes sense to describe the system we live under as capitalism. But first, would you mind just sketching out what you see as the core features of this existing techno-feudal world?
There's one core feature. It's a new form of capital, which I call cloud capital. Capital has been around ever since we created our first tools, well before capitalism. A fishing rod is a capital good to the extent that it is a produced means of production. It's something that you produce in order to produce something else, a catch, a hammer. You create a hammer in order to produce something using it, something else. You don't use the hammer for its own sake. A tractor, an industrial robot today, a very recent and all singing, all dancing piece of technology, which nevertheless is a produced means of production. But cloud capital, what lives inside your phone and your laptop, the algorithms, the cell towers, the optic fiber cables that create this mammoth new form of capital, which I call cloud capital, is not a produced means of production. It's a produced means of behavioral modification. That is an automated system, the purpose of which is to put ideas into our mind on what we want to do, on what we should do, and what we actually do. And that is unique. That has never happened before. This is a properly unique development of means of not just production and exchange, but also of communication and behavioral modification. Now, the reason why I think this is crucial is because the owners of this cloud capital have a remarkable new power that no capitalist ever had before. And that is access to an automated system which is a purely dialectical system. It trains us to train it to train it ad infinitum, to learn everything about us, to learn to understand us better than our best friends understand us, and therefore to give us very good advice, which then, because we're impressionable beings, opens us up to suggestions about what we should buy. So these machines put into our heads ideas of what we should buy, which are the result of a dialectical process, not just a one-way directional move from the ideas of an advertiser to us, but it's a two-way dialectical process, which puts into our mind and our soul desires, and then swiftly satiates those desires independently of any market. So the same algorithm that belongs to Jeff Bezos through Alexa and Amazon that makes you want something is the algorithm that sells it to you, bypassing every market and extracting a kind of rent, the equivalent of ground rents that feudal lords used to charge vassals back in under feudalism. Now it becomes a form of cloud rent that Jeff Bezos retains with every transaction. That is not a marketplace. That is not capitalism. It is a system which has replaced markets with digital fiefdoms. I call them cloud fiefs, and which has sidestepped profits. It has pushed profits aside and turned a new form of rent into the main means by which wealth is accumulating as we speak. That is what I call techno-feudalism.
Just on that point about behavior modification, I mean, it seems clear that it would be ideal for the tech giants to be able to modify our desires and wants in the way that you describe. But I imagine a lot of people, and perhaps the defenders of those companies, would say, well, this is all rather akin to advertising, and sure, it has an effect, but people are also savvy. They are not the mere playthings of these platforms. And we can exert more control than your account would suggest. Why do you find this situation that you describe quite so frightening and dystopian?
Well, the owners of cloud capital, I call them cloudalists, have very powerful arguments. Because it is indeed the case that no one is forcing us. This is the great difference between feudalism and techno-feudalism. Under feudalism, if you were a peasant, if you were a serf, you had no choice. You just couldn't up stamps and leave the fiefdom. Whereas today, we all volunteer to operate as cloud serfs. We find the services that are offered to be to our liking. Personally, I am addicted to them. I cannot live without my TikTok, without my Twitter, and I don't want to live without them. I actually like them very much. But, you know, I come from a philosophical school of thought according to which the worst kind of slavery is the one that you volunteer for and the one that you believe in. My great fear when I was a teenager was not so much Big Brother, you know, reading 1984 by George Orwell. It was a Brave New World in which happy slaves were being engineered. So yeah. The fact that we have a capacity to choose our serfdom, for me, it makes it even more scary, not less scary. And in any case, let's ask ourselves a very simple question. You can see that we live in a world where the vast majority of people, especially in the developed West, are impecunious. The cost of living crisis came after many years of a deflationary process. The majority are far, far worse off than they were, you know, 20 years ago. This is the reason why the ultra-right is making such inroads, because people can see that their kids are going to find it much harder to make their way in the world than they did. Now, why is this happening? How can we square off, you know, understand the coexistence on the one hand of this discontent with the fact that stock exchanges have been going through the roof, especially at a time when people are buying less stuff, not more? And the reason, of course, is because cloud capital is amassing enormous cloud rents, so much so that seven companies in the United States, the so-called Magnificent Seven, which rely on cloud capital for their accumulating cloud rents, their capitalization, their stock exchange valuation is greater than the sum of all the valuations of every single company listed in the stock exchanges of the United Kingdom, Germany, France, Japan, and China put together. That concentrates the mind, I think.
Regarding your account of how, in your view, this techno-feudalist world emerged out of capitalism, in the preface to the book you write, "At the heart of my thesis is an irony that may sound confusing at first, but which I hope to show makes perfect sense. The thing that has killed capitalism is capital itself. Not capital as we have known it since the dawn of the industrial era, but a new form of capital, a mutation of it that has arisen in the last two decades, so much more powerful than its predecessor, that like a stupid, overzealous virus, it has killed off its host. What caused this to happen? Two main developments: the privatization of the internet by America's and China's big tech, and the manner in which Western governments and central banks responded to the 2008 great financial crisis." So if we start first with the privatization, or we might say the enclosure of the internet and the shift from the relative freedom and openness of its early days to the heavily commercialized internet we know today, can you say something on that process and why you view it as being one of the key factors that has laid the basis for what you argue is this supersession of capitalism by techno-feudalism?
Cloud capital was developed in the environment provided by the privatized internet. So the privatization of the internet, the new enclosures, as I call it, was central in giving birth to cloud capital. So how did that happen? Well, as you mentioned, the first internet, the original internet, was a kind of commons. It was a capitalism-free zone. It was a corporation-free zone. I remember using it. I'm old enough to remember the internet before it was called the internet. When I used to live in Britain, I used to work on it or use it, and it was called JANET, the Joint Academic Network, back then when I was at the University of East Anglia and in Cambridge. And it was a true commons. People actually produced programs, coded applications, and just set them free on that internet. Even to this day, when you look at whether you're using Chrome or Bing or whichever, or Safari, whichever program you use in order to gain access to a URL, to a website, you'll see these little letters at the top, http://, whatever. HTTP was a program that somebody wrote. Didn't make a single cent out of it because the person who wrote it made it available to everyone to use for free. A little bit like GPS was made available for free by the Pentagon. So that was the original internet. That was privatized. And it was privatized primarily due to the fact that you and I do not own our digital identities. So companies like Google and Facebook, as well as our bankers, created applications where you could identify yourself only through them. And once they had enclosed us in those applications, courtesy of us lacking the capacity to prove who we are, then that was the beginning of the privatization of the internet. And that was essential for bringing about the conditions that spawned the cloud thieves, like Amazon, like Google, like Facebook, like Uber, like Airbnb, and so on and so forth.
Some would argue that the enclosure of the internet is comparable to other instances in which resources that had been held in common were then appropriated, whether that be the agricultural commons that enabled the emergence of capitalism, or the efforts of modern corporations to push the boundaries of what can be privatized and marketized. And though some would argue that those acts of enclosure may have been outside the internal logic of capitalism, as sort of classically conceived, they are in no sense acts that undermined the rule of capital, in fact, quite the opposite. Why do you think then we shouldn't see the privatization of the internet and the development of the platform giants as comparable to those other instances of enclosure?
Well, the original enclosures of the land in England, Wales, and Scotland spawned capitalism, because what they did was they created a working class that was landless. The people who were evicted from the enclosed lands became the first working class. And eventually, after many decades of mind-numbing poverty and destitution, the survivors and their descendants became the proletariat, manning and womaning the factories, the dark satanic mills. There's no doubt that capitalism could not have happened without those enclosures. But what these new enclosures, as I call them, have done, is they've spawned a new kind of capital that upends capitalism. In what sense? In the sense that the moment, for instance, you move into Amazon.com, which is built on this kind of cloud capital, it is an enclosure that now, instead of throwing us off the land like the original enclosures did, what the new enclosures do is they are creating a digital fiefdom in which we are attracted by remarkably useful services and pieces of advice and capacities that we never had, things that we volunteer to enter the cloud fief in order to get. And once we are there, vassal capitalists are also attracted to provide us with goods and services that the algorithm belonging to Jeff Bezos chooses us to know about and to crave. And once those vassal capitalists and we, the users, are enclosed in this new digital fiefdom, then it's game over for capitalism, because suddenly we have a trading platform, which is not a market, because there is no degree of decentralization. You and I, if we, you know, enter Amazon.com together and we type the same thing inside the search engine of Alexa or Amazon, we'll get completely different recommendations selected by the algorithm. We cannot talk to one another as buyers. We cannot talk to sellers. It is the equivalent, as I say in the book, of you and I walking into a shopping mall, into a digital shopping mall. You know, we walk together, we train our eyes towards some shop window, but we see different things depending on what Jeff Bezos' algorithm wants us to see. That's not capitalism.
That seems intuitively very plausible when we think about the experience of operating within these monopolistic entities. But there is still the prospect, even if not necessarily the reality right now, of competition between such entities. So, I mean, if we take just an example of a different platform company that is widely seen as parasitic and representative of this shift towards rentierism and the creation of artificial scarcity and so on. So on the left and more broadly, Spotify is criticized for the ill effect it's had on artists who are mostly paid very little by the platform, and for profiting by getting us to pay for music that in theory is infinitely replicable and that everyone could own, and that Spotify in effect is getting in the way of both easier access to music and better remuneration for artists. And then from your point of view, it's also a threat to our digital identities. As you've described, its business model relies heavily on mining our data and then shaping our preferences. But is there a danger of missing the fact that although, yes, it does do these things, it's also in certain respects a more conventional company. It's in competition with other streaming services such as Apple Music, Amazon Music, Tidal and so on. And it's also arguably selling a product beyond just the music that it controls. It's providing a particular interface and a user experience that competes on the market with similar products provided by those other companies. So I wonder if there might be a bit of a danger of looking at the tech platforms and being so dazzled by what's novel that we might miss aspects of their business models that are actually quite conventional.
There's nothing conventional about them. This is an illusion. And it's an illusion that stems from confusing competition for rivalry. What there is between Spotify and Apple Music is rivalry, but there's no competition. Because once we are invested in Spotify, once you're using it, once Spotify knows you and starts recommending things, which I don't know about you, but whenever Spotify recommends music to me, because it knows me so well after years of me using it, its recommendations I appreciate.
Yeah.
For me to move to Apple Music, it would take another year or two to get the same kind of quality of recommendations. Under feudalism, the fiefs were not static. Some were rising, some were falling. There were wars between them. There was rivalry. The feudal world was not in stasis. Similarly, Apple Music, look, for instance, I'll give you another example, Facebook vis-a-vis TikTok. TikTok has appended, you know, much of the space occupied by Facebook. You know, Zuckerberg was and remains challenged and threatened by TikTok. But that kind of threat that Zuckerberg feels is much more reminiscent of the threat that certain feudal lords felt during under feudalism from other feudal lords. It's not a competitive system to the extent that you cannot simply step out of Spotify, go into Apple Music, and get a song that you couldn't have gotten for the same price or for no price at Spotify. It means leaving a whole world behind, transferring your data to another fiefdom. You can do it, but the costs of switching are absolutely prohibitive for the vast majority of users. Now, it doesn't mean that they won't switch at some point, like they switch from Facebook to TikTok. But TikTok is simply another kind of thief in which they entered by leaving Facebook. They never went back to Facebook once they got to TikTok. So, yes, it's fluid. Yes, there is rivalry. Yes, there's even war between different cloud thieves. Indeed, as I say in the last part of my book, to a very large extent, the new Cold War is the result of the clash of two techno-feudal realms, the one based on Silicon Valley and the one based in Shanghai or Shenzhen in China. But to think of this in terms of market competition is to mistake the epoch in which we're living.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting on that example of Spotify, and as you described, the difficulty of moving from that platform to another. I mean, for instance, it's now widely known that Spotify's, the actual streaming quality is perhaps the worst of all of these platforms. You know, you get better streaming quality on Apple or Tidal or something like that, and I'm aware of that, and I think about moving, and I never do, and I'm still on Spotify, so that would seem to substantiate what you're saying there.
Indeed. Also take Twitter. I mean, everybody wants to get Twitter, but no one can. I mean, for me to leave Twitter, it means I have to leave more than 1 million followers behind.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Another aspect of the techno-feudalist argument that some critics have taken issue with is by pointing to the fact that the tech platforms spend very substantial sums of money on research and development, which would seem to be a peculiar thing for parasitic, feudal rentiers to be doing. For example, in his widely read article in the New Left Review, Evgeny Morozov writes that if the tech giants really are lazy rentiers who are ripping everyone off by exploiting intellectual property rights and network effects, why do they invest so much money in what can only be described as production of some kind? What kind of rentiers do that? Can you explain why you are unpersuaded that the scale of R&D spending by the platform giants contradicts your argument?
Because Evgeny Morozov missed the point completely. I have never argued that we went back to feudalism. I've never argued that Jeff Bezos is not a capitalist. I've never argued that cloud capital is land. No, it is an old singing, old dancing, high-tech product of immense investment and, you know, sparkling and glimmering and glistening research and development. My point is that we haven't gone back to feudalism. No, we've moved forward to something worse than capitalism, which I call techno-feudalism. It has elements of feudalism in it, in the sense that rent has replaced profit, but it is not ground rent. It is not rent that you collect simply because you were born in the right family. No, Jeff Bezos was not born in the right family. I don't even know what family he was born into, but I don't care. He's an entrepreneur. He's a capitalist. He's invested huge amounts of capital. You know, Elon Musk, I consider him to be a brilliant engineer. Mad and bad and completely threatening to civilization, but nevertheless brilliant. These people are entrepreneurs. They created the cloud capital, which, however, enables them to build what I call the cloud thief, where we are encased voluntarily, along with vassal capitalists, the result being the extraction of huge amounts of rent, cloud rent, by the owners of that cloud capital. So I don't find the Morozov critique interesting.
So the second key development that you point to as being critical for what you believe to be this emergence of techno-feudalism is the way in which Western governments and central banks addressed the 2008 financial crisis, and in particular the rollout of quantitative easing, which you argue when coupled with austerity, had the effect of destroying productive investment and led to what you describe as gilded stagnation. And you also describe how a second round of QE that occurred during the COVID-19 pandemic had similar effects whilst also sluicing funds towards the big tech companies. Can you talk about that process and how, in your view, this helped to lead to the displacement of profits by rent, as you describe?
Well, to begin with, let me make this very clear. This is not a conspiracy theory. I'm not arguing that the central bankers and the governments got together in April 2009 in London under the chairmanship of Gordon Brown and decided, okay, here's how we're going to produce $35 trillion in order to fund cloud capital and techno-feudalism. No. Nothing would be further from the truth. What happened was that the second post-war phase of globalized capitalism, the first phase was Bretton Woods, the second phase was the irrational exuberance years of neoliberalism and financialization and globalization, the globalization of finance effectively. That era led to monumental bubbles in the financial sector, which blew up, as we very well know, in 2008. And then suddenly governments were in a state of panic, analytically incapable of understanding what happened, and morally unable to tell the financiers that they may have to save their banks, but not them. So they saved, they bailed out the bankers. The result was a combination of socialism for the bankers and harsh austerity for the many in the United States, across Europe, in the United Kingdom. When you have austerity that is universal austerity, on the one hand, that dampens aggregate demand, that kills investment in things society needs. But at the same time, you have socialism for financiers, $35 trillion being printed by our great and good central bankers. That money is given to the financiers. The financiers have to hand it over to some capitalists to invest it. The capitalists that produced physical stuff and traditional capital, analog capital or terrestrial capital, just wouldn't invest, because why would they when the many are impecunious? The only people who took that money and didn't just go back to the stock exchange to buy back their own shares in order to boost their share price and therefore the bonuses were the Jeff Bezoses and the Zuckerbergs and the Googles and the Apples of the world. They took this money. $9 out of $10 invested by Zuckerberg on Facebook came from that central bank money. So this is the delicious irony. You've got the state and its central bank producing loads of money that is, state money, not money coming out of the surplus value production line of capitalism, state money being produced so that certain cloudalists can build up their cloud capital to create the digital fiefdoms, which attract us and vassal capitalists in order to extract, in the form of cloud rents, the surplus value produced by the shrinking capitalist sector. This is what I call techno-feudalism.
Going back to your points about the way in which this is in no sense a conspiracy, you would then see a strong parallel in the shift from feudalism to capitalism and this shift from capitalism to techno-feudalism, in the sense that as capitalism emerged, no one was consciously directing this process. The people leading the enclosures were not thinking, we're attempting here to transition from one form of society and social and economic relations to another. That just happened to be the consequence of them acting in their own narrow self-interest.
Indeed, the whole process is captured by the two words, unintended consequences, just like capitalism. Nobody wanted capitalism, maybe with the exception of very, very few merchants during the 18th century and 19th century. But the ruling class in Britain didn't want capitalism. The king didn't want capitalism. The bishops didn't want capitalism. The peasants didn't want capitalism. The vicars didn't want capitalism. So if history progressed democratically, there would have been no capitalism. Similarly, nobody planned to have techno-feudalism, not even Jeff Bezos. He just wanted to make money. But the unintended consequences of the developments in the realm of digital technologies, the privatization of the internet, the great financial collapse of 2008, and the manner in which governments responded by means of a combination of socialism for the bankers and austerity for everyone else. All those things had the unintended consequence of the birth and accumulation, vast accumulation of a new form of capital, which I call cloud capital, which then surreptitiously begat techno-feudalism.
It seems to me that one of the reasons that people are somewhat wary of the notion of techno-feudalism is that the term feudalism is often used in quite a pejorative way, and that it could be interpreted that you're sort of describing a shift from a system characterized by productive investment towards rentierism, and that in doing so, that serves to portray capitalism in a much more flattering light than it deserves, because capitalism has always been characterized very substantially by rentierism, by violence, by what David Harvey called accumulation by dispossession. And that because feudalism is used in this pejorative sense, it being then deployed again in this techno-feudalist formulation in a period of deteriorating rights and economic prospects, that can almost seem, and I'm sure this isn't your intention, but it can seem to almost prettify capitalism and make it appear to be a more productive, energetic and just system than it ever really was. Do you understand why there is that kind of wariness about the term for that reason?
Yes, I do, but we need to overcome it. Nobody has ever accused me of portraying capitalism in a good light. I'm a Marxist. I never associate capitalism with anything other than a very pernicious system which turns both workers and capitalists into playthings of forces beyond their control. My disdain at capitalism has always been that it is a very liberal system, and essentially it enslaves all of us, whether we're sellers of our labor or purveyors of capital accumulation. So I understand that. But look, Rosa Luxemburg put it beautifully from her prison cell when she said, the way things are, we're facing a dilemma, socialism or barbarism. What did she mean? That the capitalist system was prone to converge towards a new form of barbarism. But I'm not saying something different. Just to say that the failure of the left to procure socialism and to make socialism a credible alternative through our substantial failures and defeats, either in the Soviet Union or with social democracy, laborism, whatever, well, that has given rise to a new transformation of capitalism to something worse. That is not to paint capitalism in rosy colors.
What for you then are the political implications of defining our situation as a techno-feudalist one? What sort of movements could challenge the rule of the platforms, and why do you think that then differs from the workers' movement, say, of the 20th century in terms of who can wield power and who can be part of a transformative coalition?
You just reminded me of perhaps the most pleasant and nicest criticism I received. A couple of years ago, I was presenting my techno-feudal hypothesis in Marxism, what was it back then, 2020 or something? Mm.
This is the SWP's annual festival.
Yeah. And there was a discussant, I can't remember his name, a young lecturer from one of London's universities. He was actually very nice. And he said to me, but Yanis, if what you're saying is right, then it's not enough to organize auto workers and nurses. And I said to him, precisely. But that's not a reason for thinking that it is enough to organize proletarians, because now have cloud serfs. And therefore, in answer to your question, I think it is essential to maintain our dedication to organizing those who are selling their labor for a pitiful wage, whether it is in the NHS or in factories or in shops or warehouses, especially warehouses run by Amazon and other such cloudalists. This is essential, but it's not sufficient. Now we have a precariat out there. Think about it. We have, as we speak, today I checked, there were 50 million people today in the West working for Amazon's Mechanical Turk. That is the apotheosis of precarious work over the internet, Peace Rates, Chapter 12, Volume 1, Das Kapital. We need to use the instruments of cloud capital against the cloudalists in exactly the same way that this is the Marxist tradition, isn't it? We are not against the means of production. We are against the private ownership of the means of production. So it is the time to seize not just the means of production, distribution and exchange, but also the means of communication and the means of this amazingly dialectical interface between us and machinery, which could become remarkable instruments for the advancement of our human and environmental agenda. But as they are functioning today under the ownership of the 0.00001%, they are functioning against the interests of both humanity and nature.
Just on that last point, do you feel like there's something particular to the platform giants whereby it's easier to envisage their owners and the way in which they operate as being superfluous and something that could be run in a socially just way, that there's something more sort of obviously apparent about that rather than, say, other forms of production historically under capitalism?
Algorithms are here to stay, and cloud capital is not the enemy, but we need cloud capital to be socialized. So take Uber. Uber has a very clever algorithm that allows its owners, the cloudalists behind Uber, to exploit both the taxi drivers, the drivers, and us. Now imagine if we socialized this algorithm. Imagine if we had a cooperative drivers, maybe connected to the municipality, to our local communities, with the algorithm allowing us to have a service which is commonly owned, and one which does not extract value from the local community or from the drivers and send it to the Cayman Islands, to the owners of that algorithm. That, to me, is the way forward.
So those are my questions on the book. But just while I have you here, Yanis, I wonder if you could comment on the Gaza situation, something you've been vocal about, and rightly so. It's hard, of course, to say much beyond expressions of moral outrage right now, given what's occurring in Gaza. But I wonder if you could say something on what you think is the historical and political significance of the global outpouring of solidarity for the Palestinians that we've seen, and what you think the geopolitical consequences may be, especially at a time when there's much discussion as to whether the United States is finally losing its ability to superintend the international system.
My great fear, and also my estimation, is that rumors of the United States losing its capacity to impose its hegemony, these rumors are exaggerated. And I very much fear that the Palestinian tragedy, the tragedy of the people living between the river and the sea, whether they are Jews, Bedouins, Palestinians, whatever they are, this tragedy is cordoned off from the rest of geopolitics by the remarkable hegemony of the United States, by the way that the United States has prevented the governments of the United Kingdom, of the European Union, from articulating a position of their own. Once upon a time, Alex, the president of France, I remember Jacques Chirac, a very poor excuse for human nature, but nevertheless, yeah. Even Jacques Chirac stood his ground and told the Israelis that the occupation forces were committing crimes against humanity. I can't imagine Macron having the capacity to say that. So this is the significance of the international solidarity movement. Our geopolitics, our governments, our parliaments, our congresses are absolutely weakened and unable to assert on our behalf the importance of universal human rights. The tragedy of the Palestinian people signifies the helplessness of the demos in Britain, in Europe, in Canada, in Australia, in New Zealand, in, of course, the United States. So in that sense, the international movement to say no to the genocide of the Palestinians. No, the Holocaust, yes, was a unique evil, an evil like no other. But it can never be a justification for the genocide of the Palestinians. A capacity to say that without fear and without prejudice, and to say that the struggle for Palestinian rights is also a struggle against anti-Semitism is essential for bringing about a new world order in which it is possible again to envision universal human rights. Today it is simply not possible. Today, when we talk, especially our great and good leaders talk about universal human rights, essentially they are reminding us that the West has a long tradition of genocide and of using the concept, the brilliant concept of universal human rights, in order to respect them in the breach, not in the observance.
Just on that point about the way in which the United States continues to exert hegemony over Europe and prevent some sort of independent position emerging, I mean, some would argue that, especially because of the Ukraine war and because we're still in a position of having a democratic president and we may soon have Donald Trump in the White House again, that this may all look rather different quite soon, because the Europeans are clearly cognizant of the fact that the US is not as reliable a partner and a supposed protector in terms of, you know, the US nuclear umbrella and so on. So do you think it's actually possible that we may be in a situation where what you're describing is true, but it might change quite rapidly?
Well, if Trump gets elected, it may change rapidly, but I would say for the worse. Because the European Union, look at the discussions happening today in Brussels. Look at Charles Michel, the president of the European Union. Look at Emmanuel Macron. Look at the way they are gearing up for a possible victory by Donald Trump. What they are arguing, and this is astonishing and very worrying, is that Europe should develop its own military industrial complex. Not being able to rely to the American industrial complex, the response is not that we should have a Europe that works towards reestablishing peace in the region, whether this is Ukraine or the Middle East. No, it is to replace the American military industrial complex with a European one. And, you know, I have been in the trenches for the last 25 years, 30 years, arguing for a political union in Europe, fiscal union, Eurobond, in order to mutualize debt so as to fund the green transition, green jobs, green investment, and so on. And I've lost every such battle. So, you know, my proposals for the Eurobond, for debt mutualization, have been laughed out of court for the last three decades. And now they are bringing back this idea of a Eurobond and mutualized debt in order to fund what? A military industrial complex in Europe. Charles Michel, the president of the European Union Council, talked about the technological and innovation future of Europe as a result of investing in ammunition. What happens when you build, you know, 5 million rockets and you've got them stored in a warehouse? What happens then? How do you continue investing in it unless you use them? Suddenly, you have an incentive to start wars like the United States have. My only hope for Europe, and I believe it is our last hope in Europe, is Europe's incompetence. In the same way that they failed to invest in the green transition, I hope and pray they will fail in this pseudo-developmental project, which is based on the preposterous idea of replacing the American with the European military industrial complex.
You've been listening to Politics Theory Other. If you've been enjoying PTO and finding it useful, please do consider rating or reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts. It really does help to bring in new listeners. The show's music and graphic design is produced by Planet B Productions. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week.